Serial Entrepreneur.
Hello and welcome back to the Serial Entrepreneur podcast. As always, I am your host Anna, the editor, and today we have a very special guest all the way from over in the US. I am pleased to introduce you all to Teo Roxon, a man of many talents as a cultural translator, storyteller, activist, author, co-founder, podcast, the list is endless, but in my opinion, also an entrepreneurial expert. So, Teo, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
The pleasure is mine. It's a great day. It's Friday, so I'm excited. And yeah, you know, it's good. And people always say Teo all the time, but it's actually Teo. So it's one of the things that I've been telling people, but that is an insight into who I am. Nigeria.
Amazing. And do you know what? Normally I ask all my guests before we go like to record on air, I'm like, oh, how do you pronounce your name? And sometimes I ask the most simple of names, like Steve Smith. Just want to double check, is your name Steve Smith? And they're like, yeah. And so I don't know why it slipped my head today. And the only day I didn't ask it and I get it wrong, I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. You did anything wrong. But I always like using that because my name actually is short for, Teo, short for Akin Teo, which means a warrior or the brave one has brought us joy. So I always think it's a cool opportunity to talk about the meaning of my name. So, hey.
So is that what it means in Nigerian?
In Yoruba. So Yoruba is one of the 500 plus languages we have in Nigeria. And English is the official language, but there are several tribal languages.
And how many languages can you speak?
Well, I wish I could speak my tribal language more. I can speak it, but not the way I want to do that. So I've been taking more lessons on that. But so there's Yoruba, which is that. There's French, English, and a little Spanish.
That is incredible. I feel like this episode is going to be so educational on so many levels. So I'm super excited.
Well, I'm excited too.
Before we delve into the deep good stuff and get into the questions, I have to ask you, like I ask every other guest, as it is the Serial Entrepreneur podcast, we ask everyone, what is your favorite breakfast cereal and why?
Okay. It would have to be a Raisin Bran. It used to be Frosties, but it would have to be Raisin Bran. And Raisin Bran, just because I love raisins ever since I had it. I don't know. It's the texture and the combination of what that is like with milk. So Raisin Bran, yeah. Bit of a sweet tooth. So
I think that is a solid choice because obviously bran flakes are really good for you, but they're quite boring. And as soon as you add the raisins in, it actually makes it a very good cereal. So
yes! It's like a party in your mouth. Like,
I am with you on that one. So that was a great, great answer. And we haven't had that one yet. So I thought to start with, for maybe some of our audience that haven't come across you before, don't know where they've been hiding, but we could just talk a little bit about yourself and tell me all about you and a little bit about your background.
So like you said, I'm a cultural translator, but you know, I do that in many ways. I'm also a professor, a podcaster, a writer and a speaking consultant. So I say culture translator because a lot of my job is helping people connect across cultures or helping people figure out how to navigate cultural divides. And with my firm, UID Management, it's a consultant firm. And I use my firm to work with people ranging from fast growing startups to multinationals. I work with schools as well. And I'm either working on consultant projects or doing leading trainings on anything ranging from diversity, equity, inclusion, you know, belonging, and accessibility. I'm also a writer. My first book came out in 2019 and it was focused on connecting and communicating in a cross-cultural world. I've been a poet since I was in high school. So I still have the book. they can't see it, but this is when I went to boarding school in Nigeria. So this is I used to write poems in this book, my boarding school, because it was, you know, I've always found it more comfortable. I always find more comfort in writing. And then professor, I teach communications and podcasting. So yeah.
Amazing. Literally a man, like I said, of many talents. Where do we even begin the conversation?
I mean, I think the conversation starts with where I was born. So I grew up in 5 countries and 4 continents. Yes. Because my dad was a diplomat. But the first decade of my life was spent in and out of 3 military regimes and 2 of them were dictatorships. So a lot of what I witnessed growing up initially was, you know, oppression and suppression. And so when we transitioned to civilian rule in 99, I, you know, my dad's jobs started taking us all over the world, and I suddenly started finding myself being the minority everywhere I was, even if I went back home, because now I was exposed to the different things and my worldviews had changed, and I was, you know, trying to figure out puberty, also trying to figure out all these different cultures. But I think my exposure to that oppression triggered something in me, because I've always been, I don't know where it essentially came from, but I think I've always been someone who likes to problem solve, but I've never been a fan of bullies. And so when I first had bullies be the leaders initially, it was just something that I wanted to solve. And so I would always study other leaders. I would write, like I was saying earlier, and then I would try and see what was working, what wasn't working. And I just used to spend time listening to all these leaders that were in exile when I was a kid. And then when we came back to civilian rule, it would be like the late Nelson Mandela, Oprah Winfrey, and all these things. So for some reason, that was where I felt like I was most useful. And so growing up in that background and then growing up all over the world made me more interested about ways to solve global problems.
Definitely. And I mean, your childhood sounds incredible. Do you have a lot of good memories? Do you have a lot of like bad memories? Like, do you remember a lot of it? Talk to me.
Yeah, I do actually. I have a combination of all those. Overall, I think it's good. I think it's the greatest thing that happened to me because it expanded my worldview. But I certainly had a lot of, memories that were tough. I remember being this skinny Nigerian kid with a thick Nigerian accent in a French-speaking country in an American in national school going through puberty. That was 10 years old. And, you know, when you're in middle school, you know, a lot of kids just say anything. I remember having to question, you know, people like, your nose looks different. Your lips are this. Your hair is that. And all these things happening. And I wasn't even 11 or 12. So I was just trying to figure out, it was like, wait, what? So I was figuring out beauty standards, but it was always slanted towards like a wider audience, because I couldn't, you know, there's nothing I could do about the way I looked. But I remember having to unlearn some things about that and then growing up. But the reason why I said it was the greatest thing is because it allowed me to connect more to my identity, my blackness, my idea of being of what type of African I wanted to be. So there were plenty of those things, but the toughest parts always had to do with the identity crisis that I would have in different parts growing up.
Definitely. And so how old were you when you first came to America?
17. I was 17. Yeah, my dad had just gotten posted to Vietnam. And I just graduated from high school in Nigeria. So we went briefly, I went briefly to Vietnam to get like my visa and all immigration things. And then I'd gotten accepted in a school in Virginia. And then, so I was there for Vietnam for, I think, a month or two, and then headed over here to Virginia about a month and a half before my birthday.
Wow. Yeah. And obviously you've spoken about it now. It's kind of like on your website and your portfolio that you've said, you know, you're a big advocate for diversity and inclusion, and you with your Nigerian origin and you're traveling around so much and being so multicultural. How do you think that that's kind of affected your career so far? Obviously you said it's made you be in touch with who you are and it's opened you up.
Well, it's been my entire career because, you know, when you get exposed to many cultures, you start to see different things. And what I used to see was in addition to the bullying, was just you start to observe systems in a different way. And sometimes there are standards that are limiting other people. So let's say we started off with talking about beauty standards. And so I know when I was younger, now I know beauty standards have changed now, but they always change. When I was younger, I remember it was like the slim, especially for women. It was slim and you had to be very, very model-like, like, you know, like the models of the day. And in Nigeria, I know my mom was curvy and I always had friends growing up there. And so we always used to have this conversation at a very young age. And I would listen to my mom and everyone that I loved around my family. And it would just be tough hearing them talk about how finding clothes or things like that and people are considering them not conventional or attractive to that. And so that got me thinking about, okay, well, how can we create a world that's safe enough for everybody to be themselves? And, you know, having grown up in the dictatorship in a country with over 250 ethnic groups, that was all you saw. Even the internal conflict amongst the ethnic groups was basically a way for people to get themselves heard. And so where I would just constantly see this repeated in different ways. It would be beauty standards, it would be ethnic groups, it would be cliques within schools, it would be, you know, so, you know, gender, it would be sexual orientation, and all these things. And I said, well, wow, so we need to, people really don't know how to interact with things that are different from them or things that are foreign for them. That's why I came up with my mission statement, use your difference to make a difference, because I would see different iterations of people trying to suppress or oppress other things that they didn't understand or they felt like was a threat for them. And so, you know, growing up and seeing this in different parts of the world helped me to say, well, nah, I can't not do anything about this. And so that's why my company became what it is.
Yeah, I mean, yes, you've kind of hit the nail on the head. Like you said, it is so weird that people struggle with people that are different from them. We're all different. Yeah. That's what makes people who they are.
Yeah.
Do you think that this really is a massive problem in kind of like the entrepreneurial scene and, you know, for, mm-hmm. for founders and for people kind of starting businesses and stuff? When it comes to diversity inclusion, there are challenges for people that are obviously different, multicultural.
Right. Yeah, 100%. I think if you look at the statistics, women and people of color receive less funding. So if you're even going down the VC route, the venture capital route, there's that. And I also think when you look at some of the solutions that are being created, they don't always factor in different types of people. And we've seen those things about how some AI doesn't recognize certain groups of people and all those things. And so it just leads me to understand that testing isn't expanding in those ways. But in terms of access to funding, opportunity, creating those pipelines for people from different backgrounds to be able to create their own solutions and allow them to be able to potentially solve the same problems that, you know, that could be solved in other communities, I don't think it's there. And to me, I honestly think entrepreneurship is problem solving. I mean, that's what it is. And so I think if you give the opportunity to people from different backgrounds, they're going to solve problems in the communities that they know, and that will expand into more inclusive solutions. So
100%. I mean, one of your first comments examples was the beauty industry, and I mean, it's kind of like only in the past few years or so that we've seen even like more darker shades of foundation for more skin types, and you know, like nude colored bras and underwear, they've always just been nude. But that's exactly. Skin color for a white woman. Like, what about, you know, black women? What about Asian women? What about all these women? So, yeah.
I use that example all the time, but I'm so glad you brought it up. But that sounds simple, you know, sounds very simple to us. But that is the point, right? It's that I think sometimes people will see it as a threat. As, oh, whoa, they're taking our funding. I'm like, no, it's going to be like, you have no idea how much, even if you want to look at it from a purely money point of view, it you know, there's so many people of color in the world. See, I don't know how you would make money out of that. And also, there's a moral aspect of that. You would want everyone to feel like they're, you know, they're seen, heard, and understood. So there's that.
Definitely, yeah. Definitely. Do you think that that's been a challenge for you? You know, the fact that you're Nigerian, the fact that you are different to other people, your skin color, have you felt that that has been a challenge for you, or have there been other challenges that have been bigger for you to face?
Well, it's over the years I've been able to adapt, but the challenges usually come in the form of immigration. I remember, we had a president, you might have heard of him, Trump, I guess. Anyways, but he was pretty, you know, Nigeria was one of the countries that he put on the banned list, for example. Mm-hmm. So for that can be so limiting in terms of many opportunities, right? Something like that. But, you know, when people normally meet me, they're often confused about where I'm from. I have to tell people I'm from Nigeria, because they're like, well, are you sure? You're English? Like, really? I'm like, yo, you ever heard of colonization? Yeah, like, you know, this is why you don't, yeah. So there's that. So I've been able to, I guess I've had a lifelong experience of being able to adapt to different environments. The only problems usually come when it's more of a organizational or like governmental type of thing, because then those are usually tougher to navigate. But there are the people that I know that have varying degrees of that. So.
And does it become easier? I mean, obviously, things are changing over in America, so maybe in that sense. But like, have you seen a change, you know, in your lifetime? Are we going in the right direction? Are things being done?
Things are being done, not as quickly as they should be done, but they're being done. I mean, obviously, we were in a pandemic and we experienced another pandemic with the racial crisis that was going on here, but the Black Lives Matter movement, which became global, shed some light on what was happening, right? But even this year, we've seen a lot of Asian hate, you know, anti-Asian violence and all those things that many people would not think is still prevalent. And so in terms of awareness, yes, you know, we're starting to become more aware of that. And I always say awareness plus action equals change. And so I think we're moving towards that action point, all right, right? You know, when people can start learning that casual joke, you can't just say something like Kung Flu, or you can't make fun of other people's accents or all these things, and you think it's so casual, but you don't know that you're actually teaching people around you to dehumanize people. Yeah. And so when they now see someone from the people that they've learned how to dehumanize, it becomes easy for them to do something. And they're like, oh my gosh, that's not who I am. But it happens all the time. So awareness for sure. We still have a bit of a way to go through with action, but we're making progress. I mean, policies are starting to be made. There are certainly more vocal voices. Now, for all the bad that social media can have, I think it's also democratized a lot of, you know, voices. So there's that as well.
I think, like you say, dehumanizing people is so interesting because they kind of are two types of person, maybe, or maybe more. But there are the people that are purposely trying to be hurtful. And there are people that, I mean, they're still to blame because they should educate themselves more. But I know some people, they say things and they don't realize how hurtful it is because society's normalized it.
Yeah.
And I am hoping that because the younger generation they seem like they are wanting to do more, that, you know, we need to change things now. I'm not saying, oh, let's just wait, you know, for the tradition to die out. We do need to do something now. But I do think as we move on, it will get easier. And I do think some of these traditions and these viewpoints.
I'm an optimist, by the way. I describe myself as an angry optimist, though. I don't know if you know of the comedian Asan Minhaj, and he's an Indian American comedian, but he said that about himself, and I felt so seen. I was like, yo, that is who I am. Because people always ask me, why do you do what you do? I mean, can look at all the chaos in the world. And I said, because I believe that it will be better. But I also do everything because I'm angry here. I think anger has been a confused emotion, especially with Black people. Like, you're an angry Black person, it's a stereotype. And I know it was, for me, I was always mindful about suppressing my anger because I could be seen as a threat. And I've been in situations where people were afraid just by my presence. And so I was always like, I can't be angry now. And so the older I got, I started learning that, you know, it's not a bad emotion. I can just be that. But my anger actually fuels me. Because I'm angry that people are racist. I'm angry that people are sexist, misogynist, and all these things. But I don't believe that we are not going to end up in the right direction. I have to believe it because it's what fuels me. But I also will not feel comfortable not doing anything. So yes, I certainly believe that we're heading there. And it's my life's work. I don't know that it'll be done in my generation, but it's still something that I feel like needs to be done. Because like you said, the younger generation is even more vocal. So it'll be fine.
That will help. Yeah, 100%. Thinking of starting a business or run a business currently? Well, check out the top 50 podcasts for entrepreneurialism, Success is in the Mind, available on Apple Podcasts, your smart speaker, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Hear from entrepreneurs who are currently forging their way ahead and making their ideal a reality. From startups to billion-pound enterprises, host Oliver Bruce speaks weekly to inspiring entrepreneurs. The work you're doing is amazing, and I love kind of like how openly you talk about it. And, you know, one of the lines on your website said that you have a gift for understanding people who have different backgrounds, and I love that. Like, I think that's amazing. Some of the people that you come across that are from different backgrounds or are multicultural, have they kind of accepted sometimes that they are going to be treated differently? Like, have some people become numb to it?
Yeah.
And that's awful to see. But yeah, how do you react to them? What do you say?
Whole spectrum. So some have become numb to it. Some are still dealing with it. And some have removed the idea of assimilation. I don't like assimilation, by the way. I just want to make that clear. Because when I was younger, I thought I needed to assimilate to fit in. I would, you know, I remember I told you I was an American international school. So I was doing everything to be as quote unquote American as I could be, from accent to changing how I talked to not bringing my own Nigerian food to the school because people used to make fun of it and all that. But over the years, what I've come to see with this assimilation is that it's basically you're stripping parts of your identity to go into one identity. And so I'm more of this, like, I'm more of a, like a tossed salad. You know, people say melting pot, but the reason why I don't like melting pot is because it just, it's, you're stripping things when you're mixing things for all these things. And so I like people, what I always work with people on and organization on is to be able to embrace all aspects of their multiple identities, right? So when someone looks at me for now, they might not know I'm a huge Manchester United fan, right? They might not know that I'm a huge LeBron James fan or all these things, or, you know, I love fantasy books as well as sports and all these things. But all, the reason why I'm bringing those things up is when I work with people, I have them tap into the multiple levels of the identity that they don't even often discuss, because our identity is more invisible than visible, yet people make decisions on those visible things. And so the multicultural people, the people who identify multiple cultures, whenever I just talk to them, I'm just like, hey, let's make a list of all the things you identify with. There isn't anything. I don't know. It could be your love for reality shows or anything you like to do. And we go through that, and the things that often come up are, wow, I didn't even know that it was okay to just be this. And when someone says that, and then they're in a company, when I'm talking to leaders, and I'm like, did you know that there's the people you in your company that don't feel comfortable doing this? And they're like, no, but that's ridiculous. We don't care. Like, then I said, then if you're saying that, how come that message isn't communicated? And then you would dive into those type of things like bias, like, wait, we'll do some internal cultures. It could be a locker room culture, right? You know, in the entrepreneurship world, there's all, sometimes there's this bro-y culture. Like it's not, a company might not say we only want men, but if there's a bro-y culture where people are making all these type of jokes or they're just making it uncomfortable for women, you might not have put that in your mission statement, but you are allowing that by not, you know, facilitating and creating a safe space for those things. And so that's what I end up working on, because that's how you get to the idea of figuring those things out, where if you give people a chance to tell you who they are in all of their essence, you start understanding that, oh, shoot. Yeah, maybe, you know, when I do say that and pick on her and she's the only woman here and we're doing that, of course, she's not going to want to say anything. She wants to keep a job and she's laughing uncomfortably, but I'm confusing that as laughing. You know, that stuff happens all the time. And so that's where I work on the multicultural element, because people don't always see that, unfortunately. But that's the first step, that awareness piece.
Yeah. And I think it was interesting how you say, like, when it comes to entrepreneurial world and when it comes to businesses, it sometimes can be harder because you want to say these things or you want to say how you feel, but when it is your job, it's more difficult, isn't it? Because you don't want to annoy your colleagues or your boss, or you don't want to upset people. You don't want to risk losing your job. So do you think that kind of, you know, the entrepreneurial startup business world needs more work? Like there's maybe slightly more of a problem here than there is in maybe other aspects of life?
Well, that's why representation is important. I know some people roll their eyes when we say that, but because we're like, oh, well, we're doing another Heritage Month, blah, 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 blah. But this is the reason, though. If more people from different backgrounds get to see themselves and get to hear themselves and all that, it is so subtle. It does impact how people end up speaking up about that, because there are power dynamics that exist in the entrepreneurship world. And yes, we'll say, well, you always said it's white males, but it's, look at the stats. Most of it is white males. Not saying it's bad to be a white male. Of course not. I would never tell you that. The whole point is if it's over indexed in that point, of course, they're going to feel like there's permission for them to do any of these things. And so when you then investigate and look at the types of subliminal messages you're passing on to women and people of color, people of gender identities, they're like, oh, no, I mean, I don't see that in the movies. No one ever makes a movie about this or that, or we don't talk about that. We don't give this platform the opportunity. And so it's as simple as, first of all, companies proactively defining what type of cultures they want to have and who they want to recruit from. Companies, for example, if they're setting up internship programs or they're trying to create future pipelines, can partner up with certain, you know, specialty high schools or special schools and say, hey, we're going to sponsor, I don't know, this for women, we're going to sponsor this in this country, we're going to sponsor this and that, with the hopes of having them build and develop an engineer and all these things. It's a lot of unlearning and training, because many of us are conditioned, by the way. There is the conditioning element of that. It's not just on one side. Some, I grew up with people where sometimes in the toxic elements of some of the cultures I grew up in would say women should go here and men should go here. And I'm like, yo. But when I was younger, it didn't really register in my head that I was like, oh yeah, sure. And then when I got older, I was like, oh, I was part of that, because even I didn't say anything, or I just thought it was normal. But that's what I'm saying. Entrepreneurs have to look at themselves and understand the solutions that they're creating, and then see how they can go back in the community that they have offices in, right? To say, hey, what schools around here? Let's see what we can do. Or in the messages or commercials they have, or in the brands they partner up with, and all those things. And it's all those little things that do end up shifting, but the representation there is going to then automatically change the culture, because other people will be able to say, nope, don't do that. Nah. And there's strength in numbers. And it's like, nope, I'm sorry. You can't just say that about what I'm wearing. So, yeah.
100%. I definitely think it's about education and knowledge. Like the examples you were using when I was younger, I can think of so many things where now I think, hang on, like, this is not normal. Like, we shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
But you just didn't know, did you, as a younger child? What you were obviously talking about was hitting the nail on the head a little bit with obviously conscious and unconscious bias. Do you see a lot more of unconscious bias than you do conscious bias, or are they both still very much around? Like, yeah, let's talk unconscious.
I love this question. And there's bias certainly exists. I think it's a little more unconscious bias to see than conscious bias, but I wanted to say conscious bias is definitely on the rise, especially when you look at what was happening in the last year over the world. Just hearing people, even though I'd heard this most of my life, but I think hearing people just come to terms with the fact that, like, oh wow, you think that, it was fascinating, because it again, when you've only known one way, you're like, oh, of course, I mean, this is my life. But when people would say, oh, I didn't know that existed, there's that unconscious bias. But when people would say, wait, she thinks that or he thinks that, that's the conscious bias. Because when people would say, no, you are Asian, and because you're Asian, I can't, you sneezing in front of me, I can't do that. I remember when the Chinese restaurants here were experiencing all sorts of abuse or like random things. And I was like, you've consciously said to yourself that people from Eastern Asia or these part of the countries are just horrible. This isn't unconscious. You're saying it. You're actually saying it. You believe this in some shape or form. And then there, you know, there were the unconscious elements of, I remember when, after the murder of George Floyd, there were a lot of, you know, educational slides on Instagram and things like that. People were like, oh shoot, I didn't know that me doing that could impact that, or me going to the school to that. So I do think what Trump's regime revealed is many people were emboldened to say things that they thought they wouldn't ever be able to say because of quote unquote cancel culture or PC. So, but you hear it. We hear it all the time. So I think it's almost slightly more on the unconscious side, but I think the conscious bias is certainly a high percentage. And there are platforms now that enable a lot of these conscious things to be expressed.
And so then another maybe hard follow-up question is, which one is harder to overcome, conscious or unconscious?
I think the unconscious ones, because sometimes, for the most part, actually, when I talk to someone and I point something out to them, you know, they'll be like, oh yeah, shoot, I didn't know that. I'm sorry to hear that. And it obviously depends on how you do that. But a lot of times with the conscious ones, you're either dealing with people that are, you know, white supremacist or racist, or people who have chosen to be prejudiced based on the platform. They've gotten the idea that if they continue down this path, there's more money based on it, or there's a more of a platform, and they're not going to stop. And the reason why, to me, those are more dangerous is because most people aren't exercising their critical thinking muscles. A lot of times people, like, you just say something and people are like, yo, she said it and he said it and that's everybody saying it, and it sounds smart and I'm going to do that. But people won't do the research, and that is so dangerous to me, a lot of the conscious people, because they know the power that they have, and they know that they have a loyal audience. And to me, I have such a low tolerance for people like that. But people that are unconscious, or, you know, people that are constantly doing things, are like, hey, you know, when you said that, you kind of just othered the whole people. And I was like, wait, what? Yeah, because you said this and that, you didn't bring up this, you know, that person from this didn't think that they could go allowed, and like, oh shoot, I didn't know. So that to me is easier than a lot of people that are consciously doing it, because I mean, they're winning elections based on it. They're getting funding based on this. So there's no incentive. Yeah,
definitely. Now I want to talk about your book. Obviously you briefly mentioned it obviously at the beginning. I've actually written down your incredible book, because use your difference to make a difference. I know you said obviously that's like your tagline now. I just think it's so powerful in such a short sentence. Like, it really, really makes sense. So, I mean, I'm guessing your whole life, but where did the idea really come from? It, like, at what stage did you have the idea and think, yeah, I want to write a book on this?
So I've been speaking for a while, and usually at the end of events, people will ask, do you have a book? Can you help us out with, you know, this would be great to have this in some shape or form. And I was thinking, yeah, I thought I needed to write it later on, but if you keep saying it, I will certainly do it. And so I started working on the idea, and I reached out to a bunch of, you know, editors and people from different books or publishing or organization. And I said, well, all right, if that's the case, I'll start working on that. And so the speech that I used to give, which is my signature speech, is how to connect effectively across cultures. I just started sketching out, there are three models. It's educate, don't perpetuate, instead communicate. And so over the year in 2018, book came out in 2019, over the year in 2018, I just started writing things that I wanted to include and expand on that I would not be able to expand on in a 1 hour speech. And then I started collecting and gathering information. And then when I felt like I had enough of a proposal, I just sent it out and I said, hey, look, this is what I'm seeing. It's in response to what's happening in the world today. I truly feel like people don't know how to interact with things that are different from them. And they also don't know how to embrace their unique identity. And so here are my thoughts on that. And so that's how the book came about. But yeah.
I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I'm definitely going to. But I've read reviews on it, and I've read bits, snippets, and yeah, it looks incredible. So I'm very excited to get my hands on it. What would you say, I mean, there's obviously, we've spoken about one clear one today, but what would you say is the real message? Like, what if readers can take away one thing, what would you want them to come away learning from your book?
Well, if readers can take away one thing, I want them to understand the ownership that they can have of the identity. In one part of the book, I said, the idea to change the world doesn't start or end at the office of law enforcement or government. It starts in our backyards and above our shoulders. And the reason I wanted to say that is because when we understand that a growth mindset and an expanded worldview is how we impact the world, you then work on your fixed mindset and the limited worldview. And many times people think that in order to change the world, it has to be the government, it has to be law enforcement, but they don't understand that it's you and your circle of influence. So if you're saying something, if you're modeling abuse, for example, your kids are looking at that, or people that are your brothers or sisters are looking at that. If you are modeling positivity, they're looking at that as well. And so when we start modeling all these things and changing behaviors around what we watch and what we see, the people that have access to your influential circle then do the same thing in their environments. And we need to do those things at home. There's a saying, I think it's a British saying, it's charity starts at home, something like that. We said in Nigeria, but I don't know if it's British. And a lot of things we need to do that we want to see in the world, we need to start doing at home. And when we start doing that at home, you find your daughters or your son saying, oh yeah, you know, I saw my mom and dad do this. I want to be an entrepreneur. Oh, they always called out that. Or whenever we saw that in the movies, they would say, no, my mom, this is a story. My mom always did this for me. I got my love for movies and soap operas and everything celebrity for my mom. But we were always moving around. We'd watch, I guess, The Bold and the Beautiful. That's her favorite. And then we were like, Tayo, you see what this man is doing here? That is bad behavior. You cannot do that. You have to always respect people. And I'll be watching the show and she would just be pointing at all these things. And I was like, okay, well, yeah, yeah. It's like, what was wrong with that interaction? You shouldn't yell like that. Okay, well, that's not how you treat women. I was like, okay, so all those little things, which I thought were annoying at first, are things that they ended up shaping that. And so it is actually impacts how I watch things now. And so just a subtle thing is that. And that embracing the idea of who you are is so important to cultivating kids. So that will be something I hope. And there's a framework for that. So anyone listening, the whole book is written in a way where you can create your own framework and come up with your own style to use your difference to make a difference. So you don't have to feel like, you know, you have to model it in a different way, but it's a lot of inquiry and a lot of stories.
That's amazing. And like, I've never thought about that, because obviously you teach your children like good things. So you teach your children what you want them to do based on them seeing you. But how do you teach them bad things? Because like you say, you can't go around doing all these bad things. So teaching it through all these like TV shows and programs, that is ingenious. I'm going to take that away. Definitely use that.
Mom's going to love it. Yeah.
She's boxing. Thank you very much.
Yeah, all goes to mom though. Yeah. Well, prepared to mom. I learned things from my mom and dad. I learned the art of diplomacy from my dad, and I learned how to be, I guess, a decent human being from my mom. And so, yeah.
That's so lovely. And I am conscious that we could sit here all afternoon and chat. So my last big question for you is, I also saw that last year you launched the anti-racist campaign, Let's Talk Bias. That's incredible as well. Tell me a little bit more about this. Like, again, what made you actually like go for it, and how was it received?
So last year was a lot, as you can imagine. And after the death of George Floyd, I was just so frustrated. I mean, prior to that, I was already experiencing a lot of re-traumatizing experiences, because some of these things that were coming out were things that I unfortunately normalized in my life, right? But the Ahmaud Arbery one was one that was, that was the one that like got me the most, because I was like, whoa, shoot. This is just, because I remember being profiled while working out. So I was in just a state of just anger and constant anxiety. I couldn't sleep. And so when George Floyd was murdered, I started getting all these DMs and messages, and they were all a range of things. Like, I'm sorry for being racist. I'm sorry I did. And I was just so angry. And then it'd also be people who say, hey, can you come host a panel? Can you come speak on this? And so I found myself in this position where people are waiting for me to say something because of the job I have, and people are apologizing that I like, why are you should know this before in my head. And so I would be in the middle of things, having to compartmentalize emotions while navigating how to moderate something. And then another day it would be speaking on something, and then it would be that. And so I just couldn't keep it anymore. And so one day, yeah, it was at the end of May, I just said, look, from the whole month of June, I'm going to show up every day, 30 days in June, and I'm going to give each of you an assignment. A lot of you sent me all these messages. If you truly want to change, I'm just going to help you with what I know, and everything, the rest is going to have to be up to you. And so that was it. I just gotten out of the shower, and I was frustrated, and I just put a video. I had no idea what the response. I did it on TikTok at first, and then it got the most response to TikTok, but I did it on all my 9 platforms. And then people said, yeah, you know, we'll show up. And so yeah, I came up with a curriculum for 30 days, and that was the impetus, because I actually canceled all my work assignments for that month and I put it off. But I didn't know that I actually gave myself more work, because it then led to people saying, hey, can you come do this at that? But it was out of pure, there again, anger and frustration. And so I said earlier, I'm an angry optimist. I use a lot of my anger for all that. And so, yeah, I just wanted to, you know, I just got tired of getting asked the same question. I said, I'll just put it out here, you know. Use it if you want.
Yeah. I think that's amazing. And it is what a lot of people needed. You know, they, yeah, like you say, they wanted to learn, they wanted to educate themselves, and they probably wanted to speak to people that had been in situations like that. So, yeah, but like you say, I know a lot of people that said, well, don't ask me, why should I educate you? Go and educate yourself. So,
yeah,
the fact that you did that was obviously incredible. And again, so... yes, thank you. Yeah. On behalf of everyone.
You know, I also wanted to say, I mean, I understand every side of this, because it is, I don't believe that every people going through something should have to carry the emotional labor. But, you know, the work that I'm in means that, you know, there are moments where I'll carry that emotional labor. But what I learned, though, I will say, Anna, is I learned how to set my boundaries, because there were moments sometimes when I would, you know, I would put out all these videos, and those things were so draining, and they were rewarding, but also draining, because after each video, you get a lot of messages. And at some point I was like, yo, this is like 12 hours of answer questions. I need to sleep. And then there'll be someone who would send me a DM and was like, hey, in this, can you modify it in this way? And I had to learn how to say, look, I'm not doing this. Before, I wouldn't have said that, but I had to learn how to find that myself, because I was like, are you serious? I just spent all this time. Now you want me to, cause you're like, it'd be really, I'll really appreciate it if you put this. I'm like, what? Julian yourself. But I didn't say it that way. It was in my head. But that's what I'm trying to explain to people, is that's where that energy comes from. Cause I can, you know, I can hear how jarring that can be for someone. I'm like, wait, I'm trying to do the work. But that could be like the 50th time someone has heard it. And like, yeah, I can't, you don't tell me how to be yourself. You know, why am I teaching you how to do that? And so there's that. But yeah, that's nuance to that, I guess.
I think that's one of the most important things as well, being an entrepreneur, and not just an entrepreneur. I said at the beginning, a man of many talents. You do so much.
Oh, thank you.
Setting boundaries, you know, and knowing when you can say no to people, or, you know, I have had enough, is so important for yourself. So, yes. So finally, to kind of wrap things up, I know you've obviously sprinkled so much knowledge and advice all the way throughout of this conversation. I'm going away with a few learning points myself, and also angry optimist. That is my favorite saying ever now. So I'm gonna remember that. I'm just gonna be like Tayo the angry optimist.
use it. I love saying that, because it's such a juxtaposition, and I'm a walking contradiction. I actually think most people are walking contradictions. And most people, I think everyone's a hypocrite at some point in their life. But yes, I like saying that, because people are like, wait, what? Aren't they opposite?
Yes, yeah. No, I love that so much. But yes, my final question for you today is, what advice would you have to all entrepreneurs, and not just entrepreneurs, all people out there, when it comes to the importance of diversity and inclusion?
I would encourage people to look at different ways, think about their biases and their triggers and the values. So I call you BTVs. And so this is, I'm going to tell you how your biases, where your biases come from. Your biases come from story, fear, avoidance, and security. So story, essentially, maybe it's a religion or something, a philosophy that has been passed on to you, or something you've repeatedly seen in media. So what stories do you believe about the world you live in? But your triggers are how your body reacts when certain things happen. This is not a time for you to judge yourself. I don't want you to be harmful to yourself. Like I said, we're all hypocrites. There are many things that we've done that we'll probably like to take back. But when, you know, a trigger could be maybe when someone from a different race is walking next to you, you tend to go to the other side of the street, or you get nervous when a man is there, or when a woman is there, when all that. List out all those triggers based on what you found out. You could be a combination of, yeah, I was told a story about Muslims. That was my story. I've had a fear because anytime I go to this place, people from this background are always harassing me. So that means that's how I got there. Avoidance. I avoid the difficult conversations about politics. And you know, when you avoid things, sometimes your brain is filled with whatever is out there. And then security is a way for me to feel better about myself. You know, I was always told that I needed to do this so that, you know, people that trigger my insecurities can't harm me. And so when you create that list, you're going to find, okay, so I know my heart starts to beat quicker, then I go here. And then the last part would be your values. I find that when people stray away from the values, they become less inclusive. And so what I mean by that is, most of us live in a more conditioned world as opposed to an intentional world. And so I do a workshop where I ask people to list out the 5 core values, and most of them can't. 4, most of them can't. 3, most of them can't. 2, maybe they can do 1. But that just tells me that if you can't readily name your 5 core values, and mine are curiosity, compassion, creativity, you know, joy and courage. And so 4 C's and one J, if you can't list out your core values, it means that you're just reactive. And so when you do an exercise of listing out each of your 5 core values, and I put 5 because it stretches you, you then have to intentionally fill those value cups. Any company that falls down for something morally object is not doing something according to their core values and their mission statement. Nowhere in their mission statement do they say they promise to embezzle $20 million and create unsafe environments for women and people of color. And so BTVs, list your biases, understand your triggers according to those biases, and then intentionally live according to your 5 core values. And doing those ways, you're going to find that you're going to be way more inclusive and more introspective than you actually think, because you're going to be reflecting on certain behaviors that you have. And those behaviors are going to lead you into an inquiry mode that you're like, oh, that's where that came from. I can work on that. Or that's why I do that all the time. So yeah.
That's incredible. I'm going to go and think of my 5 core values now. Like, See, I will, and I'll message you. I've learned so much with you in these past 45 minutes than I ever have in my whole life about these sorts of topics. I feel like we are missing out a trick. Yeah.
Thank you so much. The book has all this there. So, you know, if you're looking for that, I wrote the book in such a way where you can make notes and do all that.
I'm going to dig into the book now myself, and I recommend it to anyone who's listening to this podcast. By the time this podcast airs, I will have read the book. So people contact me and I will tell you how great the book is.
Thank you so much.
But no, thank you so much for being our guest today. And honestly, like, I think this has brought so much value to us and to our community, because as I say, you are such a knowledgeable guy. So it's been our absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure. You asked such great questions.
Serial Entrepreneur.